that's what Zionism has said, is mm-hmm. to build an empire from the Nile to the Euphrates. It's as simple as that.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Daniel, do you think that this will be a wake-up call for the Arab regimes and other Muslim regimes that have been facilitating the Israeli regime during this whole genocide against the Palestinians, have been helping them basically avoid the boycott or the blockage? Your thoughts, is this going to be a wake-up call for those regimes?
I don't think so. I do not think that it's going to be a wake-up call. On the contrary, I do think that we have to look into to what extent these regimes have been collaborating with the Israeli regime and to what extent their economies, their military-industrial complex are intertwined to a large extent, how these regimes are actually allies of the Israeli regime, in spite, of course, of popular and large public protest against the ongoing genocide. And I completely agree with what the other speaker has said, and also in reference to the Zionist ideology, which has very transparently announced its genocidal conquest over a century ago. And at the core of this issue is the ideology of Zionism, which is a genocidal ideology that seeks to eliminate everything that stands in its way. So there isn't room in this case for negotiations, for diplomatic approaches with the Israeli regime. On the contrary, what we see today, the ongoing bombardments and the expansion, the geographic expansion of the Israeli aggression is a result of the fact that the Israeli regime has been allowed by the international community, including by the dominant Arab regimes, to get away with all of its violations. And even worse, it has normalized this genocide that didn't, of course, start in October 2023, but it has been an ongoing genocide that Palestinians have had to face under the conquest of Zionism. But the Israeli regime has normalized this violence and has done so, of course, to some extent with the help of the Arab regime. So I think what we might see more is, of course, a continuity of this so-called diplomatic approach, where we might see some sort of condemnations, but effectively the fact is that these regimes are collaborating with the Israeli regime and aren't there to oppose it. And if we go back to earlier this summer, of course, the U.S.-Israeli attack on Iran, the illegal act of war against Iran, and the Arab regime's response to that showed us again very well how they are aligned with the U.S. and Israeli position, and how they did not have any issue with using their air defense systems when Iran was defending itself against the Israeli regime. So I think there's mm-hmm. a lot of examples currently and historically that have shown the collaboration between these regimes. So this is why I think that's a structural issue in this case.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, Mazen, as Daniel said, talking about these regimes, he doesn't think it's going to make a difference. But what about the reality is that their own existence is being threatened by the Israeli regime, that if they do not act, if they do not stop, as you said, the greater Israel plan, they will be drowned sooner or later. So what is it, what would it take for them to wake up for their own existential existence?
That's a very good question. How much more can Israel do to keep these Arab regimes following Washington orders, which come, of course, as I said earlier, from Tel Aviv, thanks to the AIPAC and the Zionist lobby, and thanks to blackmail of presidents like Trump via the videos that Epstein produced for the Mossad, thanks to many other factors that allow the Zionist lobby to control U.S. foreign policy, and by extension, of course, pressure those regimes. I mean, I don't want to make Qatar equal to United Arab Emirates or anything like that. Qatar is still a bit more rational, and they have more likelihood of changing their behavior than, let's say, Bahrain or Morocco or United Arab Emirates. But clearly, the situation is reaching points where it cannot continue anymore. And the world is changing, and these regimes, if they have any advisors that read the cards, so to speak, that understand what's going on, that understand that Venezuela stood up to the United States, and now the U.S. Marines and ships are withdrawing from near Venezuela, that the U.S. could not continue its attack on Iran, that the U.S. is failing against China and Russia and many other countries, that BRICS are rising, the coalition of countries, etc. They should read the cards. They should read what is happening, and they should understand that the world is changing, and they shouldn't be left in the dust having basically capitulated to the Zionists. This is not being on the Zionist card side in the 21st century is not a winning card. Mm-hmm. Why? Because you're on the side of genocide if you do that. You're on the side of genocide. And being on the side of genocide is never a winning card.
Right. Interesting points. And what about that, Daniel? As our guest in Bethlehem has said, if you're supporting the Zionist regime, you're on the side of genocide. So then the question would be, as obviously public opinion has changed, the narrative has definitely changed in dealing with the Palestinian-Israeli situation. And yet at the same time, the Israeli regime seems to continue to up the ante of its terrorist attacks. It didn't have to do this today to the Qatari capital, but it chose to do it as it sees that public opinion around the world is definitely increasing against it. So why? How does Israel benefit from, for example, this type of terrorist act that it did today?
So it is very paradoxical, because there almost seems to be a correlation where, on the one hand, we see an increase in criticism of the genocide being exposed. People around the world, including in Western capitals, millions of people demonstrating against not only the Israeli regime's ongoing genocide, but also against the complicity of their own elected governments. And so the global image in which the Zionist entity has invested so many billions of dollars and propaganda efforts throughout the past decades has been destroyed to a large extent. And the only ones who openly stand on the side of the Israeli regime today are very much small capitalistic elites in certain countries, white supremacists, racists, far-right activists, and people who identify with this genocide and who follow such certain ideologies. And so while on the one hand the Israeli regime's image has worsened, it continues to expand also the geographic extent of its bombardments. And I think it shows us the very globally dangerous era that we are going into, which is that the public opinion doesn't matter to this extent. We also see it in the reactions. If we want to take an example among European governments, that sometimes every once in a while certain countries would issue some sort of condemnation or a claim that they would be thinking about announcing or planning some sanctions as a sort of reaction to the popular protests. But eventually, nothing is being done, and the Israeli regime is able to continue its aggression. So there is a very big discrepancy between popular protests and popular will and what governments eventually decide to do. And we live in times where millions or people can be opposed to genocide, and that won't necessarily change because of the corruption in Western, in Arab elites, in the international community. And so we got to a point where I would argue the public image of the Israeli regime isn't even that important for it anymore, because at the same time what it does through these continuous attacks is that it continues to develop its military-industrial complex. It also, of course, uses Palestine as a laboratory to test weapons, to test AI technologies, which are then marketed for a high price. And so the military and economic so-called safety of that regime is at the end maybe even stronger to some extent, for speaking economic terms, as a result of its ongoing violations of international law.
Mazen, don't you think that at the end of the day, with the continued Israeli terrorist acts, especially, for example, the one that took place today, that it just proves more and more that resistance is the only way to deal with this regime? It assassinates tries to assassinate members of a negotiating team. It assassinates heads of organizations. Is there anything but resistance that can bring this all to an end?
Well, as a political observer, as somebody who reads history, we have never had colonialism and oppression and genocide not faced with resistance. It's not really a choice. It's not a matter of me or somebody else deciding, well, should we resist or should we not resist? Basically, resistance is existence for oppressed people. No matter how the oppression happens and the format of the oppression, from slavery to colonization to military occupation, and there are thousands of examples in history, from Vietnam, of course, to civil rights movement, to others, where clearly oppression leads to resistance. And that's the natural outcome. It's in the DNA of colonialism to produce resistance, because there's no other way. And it's not a matter of choice. This is what colonizers don't seem to understand always. They seem to always think that further oppression will somehow, quote-unquote, quell resistance. And I ask Jewish individual Zionists sometimes that debate with me, I tell them, show me an example where you assassinated a leader of a resistance movement. Doesn't matter if I agree with the political ideology of that resistance movement or I don't, or if anybody else agrees with it or don't, that's okay. Irrelevant. If you kill a resistance leader, does that kill the resistance?
Okay, and I'm so sorry to interrupt you. We'll have to end it right there on that note. We're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me. Daniel Yekic, author and researcher out of Beirut, Mazen Qomsai, university professor, historian and author out of Bethlehem. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Hope to see you right here next time. Goodbye.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Welcome back to a very new episode of Youth Station. Well, this is me, Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be at your service. I have with me
Brother Ali at your service, like always.
Yes, thank you for being here. Well, Youth Station is home. Sweet home, but unfortunately today I'm a bit of allergic, and then this is my voice, so you have to tolerate me, and I'm so sorry for that. So, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, I guess. Alhamdulillah.
Yeah, fine.
What's the topic of today?
The topic is something very interesting.
It is.
Like many people in the world do believe in naturalism.
Mm-hmm.
They do believe in determinism.
Sure.
Like you are determined and actually defined by your genes.
Yeah.
And by whatever you get from your parents.
Mm-hmm.
From the environment you live in. These are the things that are going to define you and determine your future. Now, is it right? Is it wrong? Nobody knows.
Sure.
Yeah. So, personally, I do believe that. The genes have got a great impact in your future,
mm-hmm.
in who you are, in your personality, in many of your traits. But the thing is, it's not the whole story.
Yes, but I'm getting a sense of regret in your voice by saying maybe. Do you regret like you have not somehow received all those great genes of great geniuses in the history, or you are a genius though. I mean, like in some cases.
I was just about to say that.
Okay.
I'm a genius myself. So
yeah, sure.
I don't have
That's
to
a spirit.
Envy them.
That's a spirit. Yeah. I mean, no one can deny the significant roles of inheritance. Let it be the cultural inheritance or the environmental inheritance, but I guess. I don't like to deny that I do have a free choice and free will,
mm-hmm.
and I can make my own choice, depends on my
preferences. That's the very point. I guess it's true that we're not totally free, and according to me, there's no such a thing as a complete freedom in this world.
True.
You're not so free, but then also you're not so much restricted into the genes,
mm-hmm.
or the choices that are pre-planned for you,
mm-hmm.
like where you live, which family you're going to be a part of, or some stuff like this that you have no choice
yes.
about them.
Yes.
To believe that I'm restricted to my genes would make life so desperate and depressing. And that's so sad. So I think that those people who believe in determinism, those people who believe that they are restricted to their genes, to their, I don't know, whatever they have inherited, whether it be the physical or the metaphysical stuff,
mm-hmm.
then their life is so pessimistic. And I think it's all about the negative stuff.
Definitely. And you can see that sort of attitude in so many poets or singers when like they are, you know, in one sense, I would believe that some people, they don't want to believe, they don't want to hold themselves responsible for their actions and their bad plannings in their life, right? Whenever they face a problem, somehow they want to relate it to other stuff rather than, you know, believe themselves
yeah.
responsible
mm-hmm.
for their things. So that could be an answer. That would be a sort of There should be this ability in every person, in my opinion, to find the goodness, the shiny parts of their lives, even they are drowned with all these, you know, difficulties that hardships
so
you are missing.
You're one of those people who believes in the bright side.
Yes.
All the human beings in the history have always focused on this point, have highlighted this very impact of hope, that us human beings without hope are nothing.
I'm saying that among some nations and among some people, specific culture, you see they are more open to dramatic and sadness.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So they, maybe this is because of their defensive mechanism. They like to observe more sadness. They find the negative.
They're more inclined to the negative side.
Definitely.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back. This is Youth Station, and we are having quite an interesting discussion. And I guess it happens nowadays to for everyone to think about such issues that, okay, am I really defined by my what my parents did,
mm-hmm.
or what they have inherited to me?
Yes.
What has been passed down to me by the previous generations or not? So you were saying that some people, culturally speaking,
mm-hmm.
some people are more inclined to dramas, to making things look so overwhelming, so
exactly.
negative. So, and they're maybe more inclined into the negative sides of everything.
They just need a push, like, they just open, can, you know,
but
I don't
why?
Know, fly.
I think history is an indication, like maybe they take history mm-hmm. as an indication, as
yes.
a role model.
Yes.
So whenever something bad happens, maybe that will be the start of something good. But then they don't see that in it, because they do believe that, no, this happened before and we know where it goes.
Exactly. And you don't see happy ending in their stories, I mean, most of the time.
Yeah.
Like they are seeing, I mean, the dark side of the world is really more emphasized in their lives
mm-hmm.
and their attitudes. Maybe they are more realistic. Maybe we should be a little bit crazy to live and be hopeful about our life.
Oh, that's very true. I do believe in that. I do believe that. Realistic people are more inclined to be negative people.
And there is another important stuff, like the blessing and rahmah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is out there, right?
Yeah.
So when we know there's goodness, there's mm-hmm. a supporter out there, a higher entity, so maybe we should be crazy about this part.
Yeah, a little bit of craze would make life much more beautiful. And I do believe that miracles happen only to those who believe in them.
Yes.
So if you do believe in restrictions, if you do believe that your genes determine your future and you have got no part, no share in your future, then I think you have to rewatch, review whatever you have in your mind.
But I do have a question. Have you ever had this fight against your nature or against something you knew, or you like trace it back to your parents or something related to genetic, and you wanted to fight it against it? For example, like your grandpa, your grandma
mm-hmm.
had this sort of attitude. You didn't like it or you disprove it.
Yeah.
You want to change it
mm-hmm.
in another way. Have you ever been?
Well, see, I have learned that you must accept people the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
And you shouldn't have the idea of changing other people in your mind.
No, I'm talking about changing yourself.
Yes. Uh-huh. See, if I have got anything by any chance from my grandparents or from my parents, and I know that it's bad, so I try to change it in myself. But it's not like a fighting or something.
I mean, does it take too much of effort, or it easily can be removed?
Any
by you
change
yourself?
In this world takes too much of effort.
Mm-hmm.
Any change. So no change would happen so easily. Rome hasn't been built over only one night.
But, you know, they say the sins of father.
Yeah.
So.
But do we believe in that?
Not really. Because
so
many cases, so many cases in the history, like,
yeah. Well, I don't want to open up that negative side of mine.
Yes.
Because that's not very good, and I think it's not going to be so much of motivating and inspiring.
Yes.
Sometimes in our lives, we may come to think that, okay, Yes, it is determined to go this way or the other way. But then some other days when you're in your good mood, you would realize that, yes, maybe miracles are going to happen, and the things that I have kept in my mind as determined for me have a chance to change.
Exactly.
So hope is the last thing that dies. I think whenever you wake up with this idea that nothing is going to change and everything is pre-planned for me, that day you lack hope in your life. What you need is actually is the urge to go and search for hope. And I guess hope is just right there in your heart. You don't have to go and find it elsewhere. You just have to dig a little bit deeper in yourself. And by the way, if you have a deeper connection with your Lord, I guess that would help you a lot to have this optimistic view about your future and to trust Him and to believe that even if there is something that has been planned for you previously and you had no part and no share in it, then because God is actually backing you up, then everything is going to be okay.
Definitely. And we can also point out the people who didn't have like decent father or mother or decent sort of parenting.
Exactly.
And they, you know, end up being good people.
Honorable people.
And sometimes you see they changed history. Literally, they changed history.
Exactly.
And this, I guess, prove this idea of, you know, everything is related to genetics and inheritance. Somehow it show that we cannot oversimplify the idea of inheritance has everything to say in this matter.
Exactly. Well, there's I have to make something so clear. Well, yes, of course, genetics and inheritance have got a share in who you are. That's a part of you, and that's a fact.
Yes.
And that's a real thing. Nobody can deny that. Your environment is going to have an impact on your future as well.
Definitely.
I mean, like the country you were born in, like the school even you go
your
to.
Friends.
So these are the things that are going to act like the setting for you. They have actually been pre-planned for you. They're just the setting. But then the character and the personality is something you have a great share in it. And you can change it, even if you have been nurtured in a bad environment.
Yes.
As we have it in our narrations, sometimes a flower may come out of a dirty place.
Yes, true.
There's nothing wrong with the idea that, okay, it's a flower.
Yes.
So, yes, don't be so pessimistic, I guess.
Definitely.
I would end it in only one, or maybe more than one sentence.
Okay.
Just this is just the gist of what we were talking about. Even if you are in a bad situation, maybe this is the mission of your life,
yes,
to go and change it, to find a way out of it. So maybe you have been given a special capacity to change the terrible situation you're in. Nothing happens with no reason. So everything has got a reason. If you had a bad parent, if your parents have got divorced, if you are born in a country with low facilities and there is no way for you to think of improvement or evolvement in yourself, then trust me, that's there is a mission that's been put on your shoulder to go and search for a way out of all of these troubles and problems. So don't take it so simply and do not accuse yourself. You're not accused. Your situation is not to be blamed. Just accept the reality as it is and then try to change it. That's it. Every moment is a new chance for you to turn it all around. And of course, God is there. He would always be there to back you up. So no worries. And then be so hopeful. I guess that's all.
Yeah. No matter where you have started, there's always a way out of that situation. You have the steering wheel of your life. Just keep going.
Yeah. And be so hopeful and powerful.
Hope for the best.
Yeah, you're young enough to change it all around. So thank you for listening to us. I hope it was fruitful. And see you next time.
Take care.
Yeah, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day, and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings. be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about this.
We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Latif, Ya Latif, Ya Latif, Ya Latif, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah, Ya Allah.
Oh Allah, You're the light that shines above. You're the reason I never give up. You're the one I try for. Live my life for. Give up all I have. You're the melody, you're the key. All the inspiration I need. And when times get tough, I know you'll stand by me. You are the love I need. The one who has guided me. And you know my destiny. For you are the love. And you are my life. Oh 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 oh. Oh 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 oh. Oh 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 oh. Oh Allah, your words light up my heart. This connection I felt from the start. Never lose sight of my dreams. Without you, where would I be? And although I feel like I'm a million miles away from home, I can lose all that I have. And when I feel the pain, I know that I can count on you. You are the love I need, the one who has guided me. And you know my destiny. For you are the light, and you are my life. Oh, oh, oh. And you know my destiny. For you are the light, and you are my life. Oh 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 oh. And you are my life. Oh 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 oh.
Yani has a rich history in weaving carpets, dating back to over 2,500 years ago. Originally, Persian carpets were woven by traveling nomads to cover floors and gears, which are round dwellings that are easily packed up. Persian carpets are adored all over the world. In fact, the most expensive Persian rug ever bought was a 17th century Persian vase-style carpet, which was sold at an auction in 2013 in London for over $33 million. The legacy and tradition of carpet making still remains in Iran, with intricate designs, lavish colors, and peerless artistry.
Hello again, and welcome to another episode of Bazaar. This week, we will take a look at rural cooperatives in Iran while shining the spotlight on the production of traditional hand-woven carpets. We want to see how they are made and why they are so expensive. Also, we will check out how cooperatives help support this sector, which contributes millions to the economy. So, let's roll out the show.
High-quality Iranian carpet can cost tens of thousands of dollars, with antique rugs fetching even higher prices. There is so much variety to choose from the floral designs of Isfahan to the intricate fine details of Qom carpets and the strong compact Bijar rugs made in western Kurdish villages. The list goes on and on, but rugs made in Iran's Fars province are perhaps the most traditional carpets characterized by their bold designs. So our journey took us to a cooperative in this province near the city of Shiraz in order to see the production cycle of this valuable handcraft. This cooperative is made up of a chain of related trades for weaving carpets. First, we visited a dyeing complex. This facility is a massive 22,000 square meter area dedicated to boiling, spinning, and dyeing sheep's wool. The processes are all done by hand using natural plant-based dyes. It is probably the largest of its kind in the province and one of the oldest in this field, with over four decades of experience in traditional hand dyeing. One of the advantages of plant-based dyes is that they enrich the quality of wool over time, plus they are non-toxic. The facility supplies bright and elaborate yarns to another part of the cooperative, which is dedicated to weaving.
Hand woven with the finest materials, including wool and silk, a single Persian rug can often take years and sometimes decades to create. Carpet weaving in Fars is recognized as part of the UNESCO Intangible Cultural Heritage List. In this province, materials are distributed to small villages for women to weave in their homes or in cooperatives. And Fars province is famous for its magnificent Gappe carpets.
This weaving facility gets its supplies and yarns from other parts of the cooperative. Here, we were able to see the process of how carpets are woven. Looms for Gappe rugs are typically laid horizontally across the floor, making their production extremely labor-intensive. The process of weaving a Persian rug differs slightly with each variety, but generally speaking, a bit of foundation material called warp is installed into the frame. Starting at the bottom, weavers then feed wool in between the warp, tying knots on each one. A highly detailed silk rug can have around 170 knots per square centimeter. However, most carpets are not valued based on knot count, but rather their materials, design, and overall size. While some varieties of Persian rugs follow design specifications, Gappe carpets are often completely improvised, with the weaver adding traditional motifs such as goats, trees, and dolls. This weaving facility also offers training courses for handmade traditional carpets. These establishments are particularly important for women. Much of the traditional carpets woven here are made by the dexterous hands of ladies, which also generates income for them. The This cooperative is one of 1,900 cooperatives scattered around the country. Currently, there are over 100 carpet weaving complexes and over 5,000 centralized and non-centralized workshops nationwide, too. That's based on figures from the National Carpet Center.
Women in rural areas play a key role in the agriculture sector, which provides wool and silk and cotton to weavers. The statistics show there are 10 million rural and nomadic women who contribute to agricultural production in the country. That's around 49% of the entire rural community. And cooperatives help protect the hard-earned income of women as well.
Despite Iran's rich history of producing handmade rugs, the tribal rugs produced in rural villages could be under threat from a lack of young weaving talent. So cooperatives play a big role in reviving and sustaining this ancient tradition. Such collectives safeguard the rights and income of weavers, who frequently receive the least amount of profits from their products. This is mainly because there are a lot of middlemen who make money from carpets. With that in mind, cooperatives also serve another purpose. They organize the chain of production by linking producers of material with weavers and weavers with buyers, which completes a production cycle. There are many opportunities for investment in the field of carpet weaving, especially in the field of dyeing, spinning, and livestock. Millions of Iranians are directly employed in rug making, and many more indirectly. Also, there are numerous export markets available. It might be interesting to know that one of the biggest importers of Iranian handmade carpets is the United States. This is followed by European countries. However, due to the U.S.-imposed sanctions, Americans were forced to find other indirect avenues to purchase the highly coveted carpets, which reduced the profits returning to the country.
Now, hand-woven carpets typically get center stage in the textile industry. But Iran also makes large quantities of machine-made carpets with very high quality. Iran's carpet industry has maintained the integrity of its products while adjusting to modern demands. There are thousands of designs to choose from for nearly all purposes. And Iran also exports its carpets in large quantities.
Iran is one of the top 10 global exporters of machine-made carpets. The major exporters are China, Turkey, India, and Belgium. That's all according to the Ministry of Industry. Based on the same figures, Iran has a potential capacity to produce over 120 million square meters of machine-woven carpets with some 1,300 production units nationwide. Innovation in production has been one of the pillars of speed. According to the Ministry of Industry, Mining, and Trade, Iran exported around $110 million worth of machine-made carpets in the first 6 months of this year. So far, carpets have been sent to 54 destination markets around the world. Industry participants say exports could have been higher last year if it wasn't for border closures due to the COVID-19 outbreak. Iran also exports hand-woven carpets. In fact, the statistics from the Customs Administration shows there was a 14% increase since last year. Exports of these items have generated well over $82 million in hard currency in the first quarter of this year. The government has plans to increase its exports through promoting online sales as well as pursuing Chinese markets. Around 3.5 million square meters of handmade carpet are woven in the country each year. That's according to Iran's National Carpet Center. Roughly 80% of carpets produced domestically are exported.
All right, everyone, it is time for me to step aside for several minutes as my good friend and colleague is about to take you on another educational adventure. Enjoy.
Have you ever purchased a piece of land on Mars? In the so-called metaverse, you can do that. Metaverse is a subcategory of the blockchain technology where you can practically live in an entirely virtual world. Today, I'll walk you through an Iranian company that has a lot to say in the blockchain industry.
Artificial intelligence, Internet of Things, and blockchain. These are the keywords to unlocking a whole new world called Metaverse, where giant tech brands like Facebook have expressed huge interest in. But perhaps blockchain is the top layer in the new universe. Accochain is one of a myriad of companies that are working to advance the blockchain technology and its amazing subcategory that's called cryptocurrency.
To step into the blockchain business, you'll need to learn the ABC of the market. Without it, you'd most probably face some serious challenges. But don't worry, This company is here to teach you the A to Z of the market.
When talking about cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin is what comes in mind. But a large number of new names other than Bitcoin and Ethereum are emerging on a daily basis. To enter this business, you'll need to attend special courses to analyze the trends of different cryptos. And EchoChain has it all.
One of the major projects undertaken by this company was to create crypto trading bots that can help you buy and sell cryptocurrencies at the right time and with peace of mind.
As humans, we get tired. As humans, we go through emotional burdens, which could overcome our reasoning and lead to an irreparable loss in the hard-to-sketch crypto trends. Using EchoChain program bots, there's no need to fret about our human deficiencies. The Iranian tech company says it seeks to experience all areas of the blockchain technology. It believes if tapped into, the emerging tech can serve human beings to a great extent and make our lives easier. In fact, the blockchain tech was invented to give rise to the best known crypto, Bitcoin. But today, its applications go beyond digital currencies. This Iranian company says a blockchain stores information electronically in digital format. It can be in the form of games, virtual reality, and augmented reality, or any new wild idea, such as metaverse.
The blockchain technology is revolutionizing the way we live, as it easily combines with other high-tech areas, such as IoT, to give rise to new, more complex technologies. In this burgeoning market, in order to survive, companies will need to be innovative and keep tabs on the latest developments. This company says it's already on track.
Well, many thanks for that awesome report. With that, we wrap up our program for today. On behalf of the entire team of Bazaar, thank you. Stay safe.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Rites in Our Worship. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab, on IRIB English Radio. So I've titled today Rites in Our Worship, and what this is actually mainly talking about is rites pertaining to the month of Ramadan, because obviously the our worship during the month of Ramadan is a particularly significant one. I would also add a particularly sweet one. So I'm just going to sort of be taking you into sort of a few concepts around this. So maybe I'm, inshallah, a little bit deep, so maybe just give you some extra reflection and a different way of looking at things. So basically, the idea is that obviously our rites, or our rituals, another word for that, build our relationship between us and Allah. So, and this has great significance. So, the general idea behind this is, so we need, as human beings, as Muslims, as believers, we need to be attached to what we call the absolute, which is God, which is Allah. Now, if we, and I'm just going to take some, let's say, normal examples to actually explain where I'm getting at here. So what I mean is this. So imagine we, obviously we're Muslims, but, you know, maybe we're not engaging in any of the rituals. So that means we're not engaging in any, we don't do our fasting during Ramadan. We don't read a juz from the Quran every day. We don't, and we don't pray either. And maybe during throughout the whole year we don't pray. We don't perform any particular rites. But, you know, we are Muslims. We still adhere to all the principles of our faith other than that. So in order to gain this attachment, really good attachment to Allah, if we're not doing these sorts of acts of worship, these rites, our attachment is basically still quite weak. And this is what we're getting at here. So this is what I'm going to talk about. Welcome back. This is A to Z on RB English Radio, and obviously I'm talking about the rituals in our worship pertaining especially to the month of Ramadan. So, and obviously I've just said that obviously these rituals serve the purpose of deepening our faith, for sure, and obviously with that builds our relationship and our attachment to Allah. And I particularly like this idea of being attached to Allah. And obviously I've mentioned that, you know, if we don't perform any of the rites, any of the rituals, especially during the month of Ramadan, which is so significant, then, you know, maybe our attachment is not strong enough. So obviously when we perform rites, when we perform the rituals, it's like this attachment that's developing with each time we, for example, each day we're fasting, or each day we're reading from the Quran, especially during Ramadan, then obviously just this feeling, this connection, this attachment to Allah deepens. You can imagine this is the way it works with habits anyway. If we do something once, you know, okay, so we're starting to develop a habit. If we do something a few times, then we're really starting to have a habit ingrained. But if we're doing this consistently, it becomes like a trait. And obviously, and the more we do it, then it's really part of our nature. So if you're thinking about, okay, so that attachment in the beginning was still quite, let's say, a little bit weak. So it really is an ingrained, a very deep attachment we can develop. And obviously, this is something that we really need to be thinking about during the month of Ramadan. Just take, for example, if you were to never do any, if you never prayed, never did anything else in the rest of the year, maybe if you could even just for the month of Ramadan, really just think, okay, I'm going to use this month to really start working on this attachment. Because just faith alone is really not enough. And obviously Ramadan itself, it will bring that sort of sweetness, whereas if you really focus on this, that each time we perform one of these rites, such as fasting, reading from the Quran, or prayers, obviously, then obviously we get a special elevated feeling with it too, inshallah. So this is just a different way of looking at it for you today. Inshallah, you tune into another episode of A to Z here on RB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab, and farewell for today. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Searching for the light, and you see no hope in sight. Be sure and have no doubt, He is always close to you. He's the one who knows you best. He knows what's in your heart. You'll find your peace at last if you just have faith in Him. You're always in my heart and mind. Your name is mentioned every day. I follow you.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran. We are glad you could join us. Here on Iran Radio, we get familiar with interesting facts about the Holy Quran. The Holy Quran is considered one of the most significant sources which gave rise to the development of Islamic art and architecture, specifically the so-called Quranic arts of calligraphy and illumination. The Holy Quran is divided into 30 equal parts. There are 114 chapters or surahs and 6,236 verses or ayahs, containing 99,464 words made up of 330,113 letters. The longest surah of the Quran is Al-Baqarah, with 286 verses, which is the second surah of the Quran, while the shortest surah is